I live in a place that amazes me. This is the condition of love. The eye and the soul loves that which it beholds that is familiar, and is amazed by that which is not yet and may never be familiar. This is the condition conducive to what Wallace Stegner, in describing the emotions stirred in us by the Western landscapes, called the birth of awe. I live in such a place that has never really been lived in fully before. Or if so, maybe only once or twice. For the small handful of us living up here in the Yaak Valley of extreme northwestern Montana, right up on the Idaho and Canadian borders, there is a responsibility in this newness. Not quite that of a creator, but in some ways almost, for what is being created with each day and each year is a story, and as Bill Kittredge tells us, stories matter. And first stories, I would suggest, matter most of all, in the way that the first scouring of ice, the ragged claws digging furrows in the exposed Cambrian bedrock, determine so strongly the course of so many of the other natural processes that are to come. Beginning writing students will recall that there really are only two stories in the world, a man or woman goes on a journey or a stranger rides into town. Mine was doubly rich. I went on a journey and I rode into town. I moved from the lush and verdant east, Mississippi, back to the west to become a writer, to live in the mountains. Or rather, I was already becoming a writer, had just started, but was beginning to repeat the same colors in my stories, greens and yellows. I had been west before. I'd gone to college in Utah, had skied and snowshoed in the steep blue mountains, had backpacked in the red deserts. The greens and yellows of the east had stimulated me, but they did so, I realized instinctively. And if there is one thing I believe in, it is instinct and our 180,000-year capital investment in those tactics. They did so with the quick, sugary flash of fine fuels, dry yellow grasses in August, rather than the deeper, slower, more powerful burning of blues and whites. Those colors burned too, but did so in the manner in which frostbite is a kind of burning, something deeper and something that does not go away easily. I was hungry for the cold implacability, the sleep of glaciers. I was young and needed more dream time. I was not quite ready to awaken. I didn't know why, but I knew it. Knew it deeply enough to be drawn back north and west, abandoning my life in the south and east, with the same unconsidered relentlessness, perhaps, with which a salmon turns inland and pushes steadily up into the mountains, carrying with it the nutrients from the sea. We are all part of something larger. We know this, yet we spend our days forgetting it. We are all part of something larger. There is no in-between. It is either this way, or there is only nothing. The place I found, moving toward it without knowing it was out there, was the newest place on earth, a garden, the Yaak Valley, just about as far north as you can go in this country. The bitter edge, the sweet edge. All artists, I believe, belong in one way or another at the perimeter. They would become lost if too long in the center. They would vanish, would be absorbed, would no longer be able to exert their polarizing influence. They and their kind, outcasts, may well be like electrons, the cycling negative charges that somehow hold together, relatively firm and intact, the more massive protons of society. It occurs to me that wilderness, that tiny but so powerfully charged 3% of America's landmass that is designated as wilderness, helps hold together the spirit and fabric and in many ways deep core depth of this country's soul. Certainly, the wilderness is the West's soul. And no matter whether this is realized or celebrated by a resident, no matter whether a resident realizes this or cares, the electrons spin, the center holds. In the West, there is wilderness in our soul, whether we realize it or not. There are those who assert the presence of another who loves us, whether we accept that love or not. That is what is at the center of something, and that we ourselves scramble around its edges, sometimes sensing the magnetics of it, the density of it, but rarely seeing it. The best evidence we might have of such a presence is indeed its absence. the paths of our orbits, circling around it but not so often experiencing it, and never quite seeing it, staying just in contact at its outer edges. How can I prove to you that we need wilderness in the West, that as we develop and grow, we need more of it than ever? I can't. I am neither mathematician nor chemist. There is no proof yet, but I would stake my life on it, have staked my life on it. The yak, the newest place on Earth, had likewise remained sleeping, even as the rest of the world was being born or reborn during the West's most recent incarnation. As the last of the Ice Age pulled back, the retreating ice shredded the spires and cirques of the Rocky Mountains, but the yak remained sleeping. For whatever strange reason of gravity or precession or cant or ellipsis, the ice pulled back from the rest of the West but remained several thousand feet thick over the yak. A cold spot, a low and sunken spot, with all that weight pressing down on the earth there, forming like a potter with clay the molded animal shapes of hills and smooth muscular humps and ridges rather than the jagged saw teeth of the other mountain ranges. I didn't know any of this when I first crossed over the summit and looked down into the soft blue bowl of the yak. I knew only that I felt a clarity, an awakening, a youthfulness and a vigor, a rawness of energy and beauty, a deep peace and resonance far within, even as I felt my outer bands and shells and the outer laminae of possibility become stimulated and abuzz. I wonder now if it was not a sensation that the land itself might have experienced when the last of that ice receded several thousand years ago. No one has ever lived here. The Kootenai were the first people, a fish culture that followed the Columbia inland and who sometimes came up into the yak in the summer to hunt woodland caribou and mountain sheep, but who, or so I am told, never lived year-round in the snowy yak. And why would they, when they could drop 4,000 feet down to the more tropical climate of the Kootenai River, the lowest point in the state? It amazes me to realize how very few other places, if any, there are on the earth that have been so uninhabited. The first year-round yak residents were the miners who began inching their way up the Yak River at the beginning of the 20th century. Scarcely three generations have lived here year-round. Other than the poles, you would have to go to the sand dunes of the Namib to find a place with a hollower human history. But what I've seen in the yak, what I think the yak has that is so valuable for the rest of the West, is the incredible example of how these first stories matter and how, to some degree, in the West, we're all still living first stories. In the yak, no one knew anything. We were all entering the newness together. It was and is all so newly formed that even words still mattered hugely, as did certainly ideas and memes and stories. Actions mattered too, but people had to hear about them. Some seeds had already drifted in and tried to attach, but I think that ultimately the soil was too thin to sustain them. Brief and errant ideas, like the belief that you could start clear-cutting at one end of the yak, and by the time you reached the inn, the trees, the wild forest, would have grown back in, such was the logger's belief in the low-elevation rainforest productivity. But that story hasn't lasted. It lasted less than 100 years. It took some energy to deconstruct that old story, to fill in those first shallow grooves, but I think we are finally filling it in. Some things, special things, once gone, are not so easily gotten back. So now we are back to the baseline, back to the bare, smooth stone that awaits its true scratch, the furrow or furrows that will help shape and influence the direction of what comes next. Not for one and two or even three generations, but for a far greater length of time, dozens of generations, thousands of years. It is good to dream big. Sometimes I believe it is in the condition of dreaming that we are most fully human, then and when we are embracing, celebrating, observing, or even creating beauty and art. I will admit, it feels harder these days to dream big. I think this means that it is more important, more necessary. It is often in rarity that the condition of value exists. What story should we tell, then, in any new garden? What story should we nurture? Maybe it's too soon to have the answers, but I believe as an article of faith that the arts and wilderness are paramount, that they are the soul of the West beneath our thin new soil. For a little while, we did the cowboy and Indian thing and the commodity thing, the rugged, rough-hewn, macho extraction of ore, cattle, timber, furs, coal, oil, blah, blah, blah. And then those things began to run out, just about the time our macho ran out, to which I say good riddance. Also withering on the short vine was the myth of rugged Western independence. My own county, Lincoln, in northwest Montana, which, let me assure you, contains some rugged individuals, is quite possibly the most heavily subsidized county in the nation. The average income is around $25,000 per citizen, and last I heard, the per capita government expenditure in Lincoln County, EPA, USFS, DOI, FHA, VA, BPA, etc., was about the same amount. I'm told there is only $6 trillion of currency in the world, that everything is leveraged, speculated, subsidized, propped up by smoke and mirrors and faith. Every nation, every community chooses its values, just as every corporation, gifted now with the powers of free speech, even anonymous speech, despite not owning a larynx, externalizes as many costs as possible to a willing and too passive society. The coal companies, the oil and gas companies, the humanities, the ranchers, we're all living in the speculative bubble of one subsidy or another. Contemporary humankind is in no way a sustainable venture. Instead, we are a newcomer, an experiment in the garden. A beloved one, perhaps, but not, it would seem, yet sustainable. Let me just say this. It takes money to live in a hard place, and the harder the place, the more money. And likewise, sometimes beauty is not cheap. Wilderness, however, the most deficit-neutral policy on the books, the gold standard for an unsubsidized existence, and provider of basic ecosystem services we can no longer even afford, and yet cannot afford to not have, is the finest investment in sustainability a region can make. And it grieves me that the so-called conservatives do not marvel at and revere this simple truth, but instead seek with the force of dogma to eradicate, eliminate, liquidate any and all potential wilderness. It's been 30 years since Montana has passed a wilderness bill. The Yak itself is at year 47 without wilderness and still counting. The vine of that old story has completely withered. The pipe dream, fairy tale, children's bedtime story of the Westerner as a rugged individual needing nobody. We might have had nobody out here. The West can be a lonely, isolate place, exhilaratingly so for some. But to say we need or needed nobody is just false. Maybe this, then, is the spirit and identity of the West, the tension, the at times vast space between the needing and the not getting, and the spaciousness that we allow to surround our loneliness. It is not necessarily that the ache or solitude of each human soul, the human condition, is so different in the West, but that here this human condition is not compressed. It has space in which to resonate, to echo off different walls, to roll across deserts, to slide over snowy slopes, unobstructed and undeflected by others of one's kind, who, paradoxically, are not always even the antidote. Here's a story. A little story from the dark, far woods of the Yak, where we yet have barely any soil whatsoever. A young man, a man of art, Scott Daly, who has protected the Yak, who has dreamed wild visions for it, assembled grand puppet spectacles, organized parades and week-long musical festivals on behalf of Yak Wilderness, and just across the state line in Idaho, a community radio station broadcasting culture and music over a land where few have ever resided, is exfoliating. He came here from the east, and now he's being carved and cut, reduced to whatever one last thing burns within him. He saw the Yak, fell in love with it, and the Yak, the wild Yak, continues to glow and prosper because of his choices, his efforts. He is building the soil in a garden where the soil is so thin that it barely covers the crackling heart, the crackling essence of the bare stone. He keeps shedding pieces of himself in the most dramatic fashion. This is the way gardens are made. Soil is created slowly, and something or someone new drifts into that waiting garden. And it's the way history is made, too. We're all shedding something every day, exfoliating like crazy with every hour spent or not spent. Each of us is building the soil and the soul of the West, whether we aim to or not. Scott has a bad bone cancer, has been fighting it for years. Sometimes it spreads to his lungs. He's had the tumors removed, then a leg and a hip. He's had the spots burned off his lungs. It stayed out of his brain. He's still Scott. He's still writing grants for the Yaak Valley Forest Council. He keeps limping along. His daughters are 10 and 7. His wife, a massage therapist, can't work anymore. The stress of their situation, the one they inhabit now and the one to come, has given her chronic psoriasis. The skin is literally peeling in sheets and tatters from the hands she once used to make a living. Scott is one of the lucky ones in our culture because he works for a nonprofit that provides insurance. It's not enough, of course, but it slows the rate of disintegration. The Yaak can be a rough place to advocate for wilderness. Not as rough as in the old days, and that's due largely to Scott, who, in the passion of his youth, used to go down to the bars and defend wilderness not with Abbey-esque philosophizing or Stegnarian eloquence, but the old-fashioned way, brawling and fighting, punching back when shoved. The bully culture of intimidators had never seen an environmentalist quite like him. It was a time back then of death threats, pipe bombs, and car burnings, and he battled them to a draw. There were just a handful of us back then, trying to pass through the eye of a needle and into the future, into a time and territory where we could speak of our heart's desire, our soul's need, without persecution. Someday we will have wilderness designated in the Yaak. Someday you will even be able to say the word wilderness in town without getting into a fight. And those fortunate residents of the future may not even be able to imagine how difficult it once all was. Stories like Scott's must not be forgotten. They are the true and good foundation from which we are all just now setting out again. This is an astonishing thing to say. The West is not necessarily always defined by aridity. There are portions in which aridity is a huge factor, and surely more to come. But for every salt plain playa, for every caliche caprock that has influenced an artist or a community in the West, or an entrepreneur, there is also a creek or waterfall. Even here at the new edge of drought, the new normal, the West may not so much be defined by aridity as instead by that spaciousness. In many places, of course, that aridity creates spaciousness. That aridity equals spaciousness. But that has not entirely been my experience. It is true also that there are places in the West that are not spacious. But to my thinking, the space between things, due in part but not wholly to aridity, is the larger governing principle beneath which the West exists. And in that outer physical spaciousness, loneliness can take wild root, as can fear, or paradoxically, generosity. This is how narrative and story proceeds. Passing from darkness to light, from absence to presence, from conflict to resolution. As if in a weather pattern, the presence of a high-pressure ridge also creates an associated low-pressure trough. I think when we first came to the West, we made the wrong choice. We had a 50-50 chance, and we made the wrong decision. But it is precisely that wrong choice that has created the opportunity now, the still unexplored territory, of the correct choice in a territory that still awaits us. There's a lot of talk these days, specifically since October of 2008, when we officially entered the Great Recession, about the new financial normal. There is a strong belief among many that the new business model of the nation will call for somewhere between 9% and 10% of permanent unemployment. That something big has changed, that the country has not so much tilted as finally fallen, and that we cannot quite find a way yet to get back up. It is said that things are better, and it is said that there is even an economic recovery underway. But I still see the distrust in people's eyes, the wariness, and that is a good thing, For to try to staunch the inner wounds of spaciousness with money would be to retell the precise story that led to the first delamination, or whatever number this one is. I see people, especially in the West, moving more slowly and thoughtfully, not getting seduced by this recovery. I believe that we were starting to unravel long before October of 2008, and in ways that had nothing to do with a speculative bubble in the housing markets or complex financial derivatives. I do not deny those bubbles, but I think there was already something else wrong, too. I think that there was and still is a fundamental underlying dissynchrony in the path we have chosen, and it is more than a little as if we have long been sleeping beneath a thick ice cap, slumbering and dreaming dreams in which there was no responsibility, only to now awaken as a quickly warming world melts away the last of that protective shield. Now, unlike before, we can see our responsibility. What stories do we tell, then, to fill in the wounds? Not our old stories of genocide, surely. As the eastern half of the country was built on the false foundation, economically as well as morally, of slavery, so too does our own in the West, particularly, rest undeniably on genocide. If a nation or region is built upon a wrong, then should not the corrective story seek to address the opposite of that wrong? If a nation or a region has been built upon taking, should not the new stories be predicated then upon giving, in an attempt to fill in, as if with sediment such as lust, those first grooves that led to such falseness? In the Yak, I think the first false cycle has already flamed through, has burned itself out, consuming all the little fuels, the dry summer grasses that in their burning made a great spectacle, but which left no real legacy of nutritive or substantive worth. Only the thinnest scrim of ash, lighter than a feather, and likely to be whirled away in the first wind. Even in such a rough and tumble place as the Yak, the place where outlaws come to hide, the strangest proclivities are arising, as if from some place deeper than even that thin soil. A potter here, a painter there, a poet, a story writer, and most commonly musicians, flutists, guitarists, singers, saxophonists, clarinetists, drummers, fiddlers, mandolin players, bassists. In the Yak now there's so much music. Perhaps the density of the forest, where sight lines are so limited, suggests that sound is the best way to communicate, snaking along unseen through the branches, rolling over the fallen, rotting logs, rolling over ravines and down hollows, bending and sliding in ways that light cannot. There is creativity at the edges of the wilderness, a creativity in the paths we circle at the outer edges of things, especially the unknown things. The best thing we can do for the West and ourselves is to keep alive and unharmed these fountainheads, these wellsprings, these gardens, whether we consciously enjoy or even care for our wild places or not. All Westerners, whether urban, rural, or suburban, somehow benefit from the wild gardens, the wild spaciousness that is still out here in places. You don't have to understand or know or even like a thing in order to benefit from it. Another of the Yak's gardeners is Robin King. Unlike Scott or myself, she really doesn't know the deeper wilderness. She's content just to live at its edge, is not drawn into its center, does not find alluring the long bushwhack, the mosquitoes or blizzards, the sweat and physical toll. Her passion is social justice and community development. Her passion is making a place for peace in a valley where always before there has been war. She co-founded the Yak Valley Forest Council 14 years ago, not long after I published an angry book, The Book of Yak, that criticized the Forest Service's resistance to protecting wilderness in the Yak. Robin called me up one day, using a friend's phone. She and her husband Jimmy live, as do most of us, off the grid. No phone, solar panels, batteries, and a backup generator for the laptop. And she said, that's just not right, that there's no wilderness up here and that people are getting ostracized for supporting it. We should form a little group to give local voice to that cause. Great, I said, who will be in it? Well, she said, you and me. Since that time, we've grown to about 100 supporters with roughly 1,000 national associates. It's still a pretty tiny organization with perennial budget challenges, though we stretch a dollar further than any nonprofit I know. Robin became our executive director, working in an office where rent is $150 a month, heat is from a wood stove, and with no running water, just an outhouse. She does have a computer, she does have a fax machine. Against all odds, we've succeeded, with the valiant support of Senator John Tester, in introducing a bill in the U.S. Congress that would finally designate wilderness in the Yak. Robin administers a local Workers in the Woods program, too, using unemployed loggers and other local residents to restore damaged watersheds and wildlife habitat in the hard-logged Upper Yak. We've also initiated a conservation education program in area schools and after-school hiking and camping clubs. We've come a long way in a relatively short time, even though in other ways, given the 24/7 nature of our work, working in the place we live and living in the place where we work, it feels like it's been much longer. Robin goes to a lot of meetings. There are only 19,000 people in all of Lincoln County, but it's the largest county in Montana. The Yak itself, 1 million acres, is 97% national forest. Robin drives to meetings in Eureka, Troy, Libby, Stryker, Fortine, Trigo, Kalispell, Helena, Missoula, Rexford, Bonner's Ferry, Sandpoint, British Columbia, and the Yak, in addition to lobbying in D.C. She meets with loggers, mill owners, snowmobilers, ATVers, hunters, anglers, teachers, Forest Service personnel, county commissioners, senators, and representatives. I go with her when I can, but I do not make every meeting. Often the meetings are stressful and acrimonious. Several years ago, during the most intense meetings, yet another mill was closing, she would walk out of those gatherings and comment that she felt like the top of her head was going to explode. I thought she meant figuratively, but a couple of years later, the doctors found a meningioma growing in her brain, or rather on the bony skull cap above her brain. They rushed her in for surgery, sawed her skull open, removed the growth, glued and stapled the skull back into place, and sent her back to work. I think in all, she missed maybe a couple of weeks of work. Like Scott, she's pretty irreplaceable to our organization. Her work is her life. It is not a job. It is a spiritual mission to protect wilderness in the Yak. She will give until there is nothing left to give. In some way I cannot prove or even well articulate, wilderness is still the electric pulse, the generative current for the West stories, whether as unnamed backdrop or tightly focused center. The wilderness can be the wellspring for the false stories we labor to fill in, the unsustainable stories of limitless taking, and the stories of modest and measured sustainable giving. The West is not what we would call resilient. The fact that it has survived the takings of the past, the colonialization, despite a lack of resilience, is testament to the power that resides in the center of its essence. What can we give to the future? Creativity. We are no longer owned by the East. We need not be a colony any longer, exporting our dirty coal to China so that it will come right back to us into the world in the form of an increasingly heated world, skyborne lead and mercury and acid rain. We need not scallop northwest Montana's Purcell Mountains in the Yak on the Kootenai National Forest to hollow out the world's largest asbestos mine, the dangers of which W.R. Grace knew for decades, but who, until 1990, after passage of the Clean Air Act, operated within the limits of the law of the land, even while killing hundreds and sickening thousands in a small town of 2,900, with more deaths surely to come across the decades and perhaps even centuries, as those tiny disturbed carcinogenic fibers, too small to be seen, continue to swirl amidst the dust and smoke of the living. We need not give the tar sands of Alberta a permanent industrial corridor through the heart of wildest Montana. We have sun and wind, and we have imagination. I have a friend who is working as a climate change scientist. He produces his own food, rides his bike to work, but he also tries to measure the pros and cons of blasting huge volumes of aerosols into the sky to help slow the rate of global warming, protecting the tender atmospheric outer arc, the farthest perimeters of the Earth with a kind of shading mechanism. He's discovered that one of the troubles with this proposal is that will make the Earth cooler, but even drier. There is always a cost. There is always a balance. There is an accountability, an accounting of all that we have taken. The earth is essentially a closed system. It can be no other way. And we might as well start now. The West is defined not just by aridity, but by space and by mystery. And my greatest hope for it lies in two things, the physical wilderness and the ineffable spirit that emanates from that wilderness. With those things, we can still control our destiny, for we can still preserve the beating heart, the essence that differentiates us from all other places. With those two things, we can still live an extremely creative and unique existence. We do not exist isolate from those other places. Everything is connected, but we are still unique. The world desires to go on. Out of the thinnest soil can come a great and fantastic yield, the richest imagination. In such terrain, the first or easiest choice or path may not be the longest lived or most sustainable. We can no longer see the great inky sheet of the Gulf spill. Like a sea monster, it has gone back beneath the surface, has settled to the bottom of the ocean floor, has infiltrated the marsh grasses and the flights of birds. We cannot see the toxic pit of death. The tar sands mining in Alberta, where a pit, an abscess of death the size of Florida, is being dug up from beneath the boreal forest that previously absorbed North America's carbon dioxide, even as the heated exhalations of a melting ice cap begin releasing the storehouses of carbon that are greater than every barrel of oil and every ton of coal that has ever been burned. If technology is going to step up and help extend, if not sustain, this journey, it's time. Technology and a carbon tax that prevents corporations from continuing to externalize their massive cost, past, present, and future, onto taxpayers. In counterintuitive fashion, I think beauty is the caulk to plug the leaks in the ship of Earth while we try mightily to correct our errant tilt, to climb back up onto the ridge we once occupied when we first wandered into this garden, and to choose the other path. We cannot waste too much time in these burning days dwelling overmuch on the wrong stories, the dead-end choices of unconsidered taking that were so alluring and so easy. The stories we need to search for and create now will likely of necessity exist at the other end of the spectrum. It seems counterintuitive. But is not the world's beauty the thing that has most sculpted us as a species, and the West's beauty the thing that has so influenced us as Westerners? We may be the only species that makes art. Our eye is drawn to beauty. As all the other experimental outer shells of our evolving cells fall away, that is surely what remains at one of our deepest cores, the thing we must most and last defend if we are not to disappear. I fear that time is now. I fear that our outer loops and spools, the indulgent experiments, the extraneous outer laminae, are eroding, have been eroding, and we are, as perhaps we once were in the beginning when we started out in a garden of great beauty and bounty, now in a state of diminution, where that is the thing our eyes are most drawn to, the thing that will lead us through the proper gate this time and down the proper path. Things peel away from us on the outside, even as certain other things build up inside us, like the much-vaunted treasures of heaven on the inside. Any new story of the West, any next story that we wish to endure, where so many of the older, once briefly bright ones blossomed, must acknowledge that we are all smaller, whittled down, occupying a territory of diminished and diminishing physical resources, if not yet possessing a diminished spirit. The question of what is to be the future of the West is not a false dichotomy of more technology or less wilderness and mystery. It is a question of first filling in the physical holes we have made in the landscape, the pits and gaping wounds, and of filling the inner wounds as well. It is also a question of how much generosity we can find and how much respect. It is ultimately a question of manners. There are heroes out there, more than we might realize, men and women laying down their lives, men and women burning, searing new stories onto the cold stone that the ice has only so recently left. There are men and women preparing a garden for the world to come, laying down their arms and drawing a line in the sand, saying there is much we no longer can defend, but we can and will defend beauty, and will continue to celebrate it where we can, and to create it where we can, until whatever final darkness is coming eventually overtakes us, and we lie back down to sleep for a while. We have been here a long time, and yet we are only now awakening, and only now starting out in the West. Everything else up to this point has been as if but a dream. It is a bright and heated world we have awakened to, a terrifying world with loss and danger all around us, where once and long ago, inside the dream, there seemed to be unlimited bounty and unlimited time. But it is still very much the West, and the one thing, the essence, the beauty, is still intact. There are still some hours left to each and all of us. We can still do with them what we choose. It is springtime yet again, and still it is almost as if the garden has not yet even really been planted, or is ready only now for its next planting. It is definitely time for different crops and different gardeners. Thank you all for having me in today. Thank you.